We're on Daf Tesvav of an Aleph, three lines up from the bottom. Itmar. Rav Chiya bar Ashi Omar Rav, and it's very critical that we remember that this tradition goes back to Rav, because we're going to find something else in the name of Rav that seems to contradict. Halacha k'Rav Yosi. Now, Halacha k'Rav Yosi, if you go back to the Mishnah on Yudalad Amid Beis, means that if we have a question about the status of a woman, we don't know if the Boel was a guy or not, so we're going to paskin based on Rov, and one Rov is sufficient. Rav Yosi didn't require two Rovs, right? That was the Lashon of Rav Yosi in the Mishnah. He said, Im Rov Anshei Ir Masin Lakuna, Harezu Tinasi Lakuna. So this statement in the name of Rav indicates that one Rov is enough. Rav Chanan bar Rav Amar Rav Horas Shah Haisa. That only in the case of Rav Yosi, they, because of the pressing need of the hour, they allowed her to marry a Kohen based on one Rov. But for all generations, we need two Rovs. Masiv Rav Yirmiya Uli Yuchsin Lo Be'ino Trey Ruby. Are you telling me that the case of Rabbi Yossi was where they relied on one rove was the exception to the rule rather than the rule, meaning as far as the rule is concerned, one rove would be sufficient? Is that what you're telling me? Well, that doesn't make any sense. Why? Vatnan, and here we're turning to Daf Tesvav of the days. Okay, now this is a Mishnah, if I'm not mistaken, let me just double check, in Masechet Machshirin.
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, this is a bit of a... This Mishnah is going to take us till the end of the Perek, which is not that far, but that's what we have to do. So we find a child, I call this bamboo cradle, right? We find a child in a city that's made up of a Jewish population and a non-Jewish population. Matzah batinok mushlach. We find a child that's been left abandoned in the city. And now, what are the dinim? Now, as we go along, if you can make a calculation, keep a scorecard about all the different issues that are going to come up. Obviously, the first issue is the child considered Jewish, or does the child need gerus? We're going to soon see that we raise the child for gerus. But above and beyond that, we have an issue before the gerus. Do we support this child? Do we give tzedakah to this child? Do we, are our responsibilities to this child as if the child is known to be Jewish? So the Mishnah says the following. Im Rov, I'm going to just close the door because I'm finding myself projecting my voice. Thank you so much. The worst thing for me is when I start raising my voice.
Talk quiet.
Yeah. Im rov ovdei kochavim. If the majority of the population of the city are goyim, then the status of the child is assumed to be ovdei kochavim, which means he's going to need gerus. Mm-hmm. We're going to soon see that that's not necessarily so. The Gemara is going to reinterpret this Mishnah. Because what would you say if this child's life is in danger? Should we violate the Shabbos? I'm not talking about, you know, there's another halacha of Mishum Eva, you know, that for other people. But leaving out Mishum Eva, is this child a guy, you know, the full 9 yards, as we say, and therefore we're not going to violate the Shabbos? Maybe it's a Jew.
With the
dinin sechan and nefesh,
it's like...
Right, ein holchin b'pikuach nefesh acharov. Meaning, even if there's a slight chance that you'll save a Jewish life, we're going to violate the Shabbos. We're not going to calculate, well, the chances are not, and the most probably the guy's going to die anyway. That we don't say.
That's the exception of pikuach nefesh.
So I'm just saying, when he says rov, is ovdei kochavim harei zeh, ovdei kochavim, you know, as if to say that the minority is not to be reckoned with. I'm not sure that that's so.
We wouldn't do that for a non-Jewish life. We wouldn't.
That's to do with more practical halachic considerations. Meaning, what we call Mishum Eva. I don't want to get off on a tangent. Okay. But in pure theory, we do not violate the Shabbos for the sake of a guy. And the reason for that is, not that we hold anything against the guy, but we're only going to be Mechal Shabbos for a Jew in the hope that the Jew will be able to fulfill more Shabbos. That logic doesn't really, even a Jewish life is not strong enough to override the Shabbos. Shabbos is a chiyuv skila. Anyway, Im Rov Yisrael, good. Now the majority of the population is Jewish, is Yisrael. And it would seem like the child doesn't need gerus. Mechtzal mechtzal, what if the city is exactly 50-50? Yisrael. We treat the child as if he was Jewish. The Omar Rav says the following: Lo shanu elolach yoso. We have a din that if a person is down and out, financially desperate, there's a mitzvah lach yoso. We have to support that person and give him chiyus so that he doesn't collapse, he doesn't die. So in that sense, we're going to say that since there's a Rov Yisrael, we're going to rely on Rov, and we have to do everything in our power to keep him alive. We'll have to see about Mechtz al Mechtz in a minute, but now we're talking about Rov. This is the punchline of the whole sugya. As far as Yuchsin is concerned, to allow this person to marry a Kohen, let's say it's a girl, we want to marry her off to a Kohen, and we have what? We have Rov of the population are Jewish. Lo, Rav says, we're not going to rely on Rov for Kahuna. And that was the sugi that we saw before, Maila Asu B'Yuchsin, that we need what? In order to matter her for a Kohen?
Two Rovs.
So how can you tell me that the general rule is that Rav Paskins like Rabbi Yossi, and that one Rov is sufficient? Shmuel Omar, we're going to get back to Shmuel a little bit later, because Shmuel is not relevant right now at this point, but since there's a machlokas between Rav and Shmuel, which we're going to get into later, the Gemara quotes Shmuel, L'fakeach Olav Es Hagal. Now, what this means is that for the sake of saving someone's life, we're going to allow a violation of Shabbos, correct? So, according to Shmuel, what population do we need in order to activate the principle of Pikuach Nefesh Doch Es HaShabbos? What percentage? 50%. We need a row, 51%.
I know 50 is not good.
Seems like it's not good. And certainly 49% is not good. This is going to be a whole headache for us. But we're not up to that yet. The Gemara right now is only quoting Shmuel because it's bringing you the Machlokas, Rav and Shmuel. Rav is saying that Rov Yisrael's as far as Lach Yoso, it's our responsibility. Bezdin has to support this child in the face of financial need. Because there's a Rov Yisrael.
In the town.
But if you want to marry off the child to a Kohen, for that we need Trey Ruby. So we see that Rav is not willing to rely on Rov as far as Yuchsin of Kahuna is concerned. So Gemara says that this Kasha of Rabbi Yirmiyah is based on the fact that Rabbi Yirmiyah missed a beat. What beat did he miss? Ish to me to say, he forgot Hadi Omer Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav, another statement that's attributed to Rav, who interprets our mission of Rabbi Yossi, Bikronos Shel Tzipori Avamaisa. You remember that there were caravans of marketing, people coming in from the market that were passing by. She had this unfortunate incident outside in that marketplace. And what do we gain by that?
Two
robes, exactly. We have one robe Seah, and the other robe of her ear. The robe of her ear itself is not reliable because we're always afraid that maybe she went to him, and that's called what? Kol Kavua Kemechtzal Mechtzadomi. But to guarantee that we won't rely on that kind of questionable rov. Did she come to him? Did he come to her? We're going to guarantee that we have a real rov called the Parish Meruvah Parish by adding the second rov, which is called the Rov Seah. But bottom line, we now know that when Rav says that we paskin like Rav Yossi, he's requiring not one rov, but two rovs. Ularav Chano Barova, the Omar, he has a tradition, the name of Rav, Horosh Shah Hoysa, which implies that when did Rav Yossi require two rovs? That's only in that particular case of Horosh Shah, but as a general rule, one rov would be sufficient. Kashaha, what do we do with the statement of Rav that if you find a child in a city, abandoned in a city, and you want to be matir, the child for Kohen, it's not enough to rely on Rov Yisrael in the city, you need a second Rov. So Gemara answers, Manda Masliha, Lo Masliha. There are two traditions in the name of Rav, and they're irreconcilable. Either you accept the tradition of Rav Hanan Bar Rava, who says that one rov is sufficient according to Rav, or you accept the tradition of Rav interpreting our Mishnah as saying and reviewed in the name of Rav that our Mishnah is talking about a case of Kronos Shel Tzipori Ayamaisa with her two robes. And we don't know. We don't know whether we paskin like Rav and one rov is enough, and that's the tradition of Rav Hanan Bar Rava. Or we pass like Rabbi Yehuda in the name of Rav, and you need two rows. I have a very interesting footnote here. Why is it that the entire discussion here about the status of the child for Yuchsin is limited to Kahuna? Don't we have a more fundamental issue? Are you allowed to marry this girl if she's not Jewish?
Isn't she a shtuki? Because we're not sure.
I don't think she's a shtuki if there's Rov. Again, Rov Yisrael, the Mishnah says Yisrael.
We don't know where Yosin is. Wasn't that the whole idea of a shtuki?
So then you're able to tell straight away.
Well, wait a minute. Let's go slowly. What I'm suggesting is that when the Mishnah Machshirin says Rov Yisrael Yisrael, that means it's not a shtuki. A shtuki would be in the case of Mechtzal Mechtzal, where we don't know. But if you have a rov, that should be enough for Yuchsin in general, which means kahal as opposed to kahuna. Alternatively, maybe you need two rovs, according to Rav. But there's not a word here mentioned about kahal. The whole discussion focuses on kahuna. So he writes, and he's quoting the Shita Mekubetz, says, he says, le'inyan kahal, ein ladu buzeh. As far as kol, we don't have an issue really. Why? Ki this gayer basov, this child is going to undergo gerus, the kashal kol. In other words, we don't have to worry about kol. We have a solution to the problem of kol. The child, even if I grant you is not Jewish, would undergo gerus. And he adds that apparently we have a chiyuv when we find this child and we take him into the Jewish community when the child gets old enough to be megayer the child. El Shalinian Kahuna, as far as Kahuna, we have a problem because a Gioris is not allowed to marry Kohen. So if we're going to paskin based on Rov that this child is a Jew, then the child doesn't have the status, if it's a female, of a Gioris. The child should be allowed to marry a Kohen, but comes on Rav, according to this tradition of Rav, and he upgrades the demand for a second Rov. Will require gerus and consider the child as a ger. But even so, nevertheless, we're not going to be able to be matir the child to kahuna because we don't have two rows. Fine, he goes on to quote a sugi kedusha on daf ayin gimel. And he seems to address your issue, Aaron, about Asufi and so forth and so on. Now, Brian mentions that maybe in our time we can do, I assume you meant DNA testing. Is that what you meant?
I mean, there's two different
what did
ways.
You mean?
I mean, if I saw a guy who's got, he looks Jewish, you know, he had tattoos on him,
Sometimes you can tell by his appearance. But you know what? I don't know how reliable that is, Brian. I've seen pictures of people. I've seen people who look like such goyim, and it turns out they're Jewish. Of course, there's so many mixed marriages and this and that. I don't know. As far as DNA testing, even if that's reliable, I don't know enough about the science of it. But here you find a child, and no one's willing to claim parenthood to this child. I don't know exactly whether DNA can tell you who the child's parents are if you have no clue. Meaning, if let's say you limit your control group to two candidates, and you want to know which of these two candidates is the parent, you can check the DNA. But I don't know if you find the child in the street. I'm not sure if DNA testing is going to help you. Gufa. Okay, now the Gemara picks up the machlokes between Rav and Shmuel about the Mishnah in Machshirin. Matzav ba, we find in the city, Tinok Mushlach, Imrov Ovikochavim, Ovikocham Rov Yisrael, Yisrael Mechzal Mechzal Yisrael. Vilma Rav, Lo Shadu, when do we rely on Rov? Elolach Yosef. We have a responsibility to support this child. So let's say Bezdin collects a community chest. They will take money out of the community funds in order to support this child, because this child is assumed to be a Jew. Aval Yuchsin Lo, because we need two ropes. Fine. Shmuel Omar. Shmuel says, in what sense, or relative to what din, do we establish based on Rov that the child has the status of a Jew? Lefakeach olav esagal, in order to violate the Shabbos. Says the Gemara, why do you need Rov for that? Umi Omar Shmuel Hachi, does this jive with what Shmuel in general says? Omar Rav Yosef, Omar Rav Yehuda, Omar Shmuel, Ein holchem bepikuach nefesh achar Rov. In other words, even if we have a slight chance, whatever the small percentage statistical probability is to save a person's life, we will violate the Shabbos in order to do so. We're not going to rely on Rov. So therefore, in this case of a Tinok Mushlach, why would Shmuel say that you need a Rov to establish him as a Jew in order to violate the Shabbos of Hakeach of Sagal? Even if it was Mechza al Mechza, and I have a feeling that even if it would be Rov Akum, we should be able to violate the Shabbos.
Right. There's like a 1% chance he's a Jew. Yeah.
Right. So I'll tell you what I was thinking. I mean, honestly, the Gemara is not going to go down my pathway, but I'll tell you what I thought logically. When Shmuel says that Ein Holchem BeVikuach Nefesh Achar Rov, the case, the reality is such that there's one absolute certain assumption that the person is Jewish. Mm-hmm. Now you want to know, will this effort save his life? And as you said before, maybe there's 1% of a chance that by violating the Shabbos will successfully save his life. That's what Shmuel says, Ein Holchem BeVikuach Nefesh Achar Rov. But a preview question and introductory question as to what the status of the child is the child a Jew or not? That has to be determined by the universal laws that govern Sfeikas. I don't know whether this child is Jewish or not. You want to know whether this method, if I implement it, will save his life or not? Okay, forget about Rove. You know, my son is in Atzola, right? So he goes out on Shabbos for calls. I mean, sometimes it's almost a done deal, you know. They're resuscitating someone who's already gone. It could be a person who's never, whatever. But there's a chance, you know. So you got to do what you got to do. That's what that soul's there for. But at least you know the status of the child. Shmuel is being mafkia. He's neutralizing the normal universal principles of sfeikas. You know, what kind of hachra and what kind of statistics will tip the scale? That's only when the very basic premise is a given. It's a certain. if you have to first decide question number one before you get to question number two, before you decide on the specific method, first decide whether the child is Jewish or not. I don't know if you can say, well, there's a 1% chance that this child is Jewish, let's violate the Shabbos. You don't even know if the child is Jewish to begin with.
It would be interesting a case that if you get, Hatzalah does receive a call, and it's a little more difficult maybe in Israel, but do they determine, right, are they responding to a Jewish person or not?
Well, no, I don't think so, because again, that's Ava already, you know, that...
But even I'm not getting to the Ava issue. Maybe it's
you want to know in theory, like
no, what, I'm not saying theory.
Practice Ava.
I'm saying maybe halachically that this issue of a percentage, even a 1% chance that it's a Jew, that you do have to respond to it. In other words, reading it straight up, not the way that you just presented the idea.
Again, what I'm suggesting is if
we say by bikuach nefesh that we don't go according to a rov.
Right, but my contention, you can either accept it or not.
No,
the Gemara doesn't seem to be operating.
But I'm suggesting
I don't even know if the child is Jewish.
No, but that's what I'm suggesting. Maybe that's what this means. In other words, even where you're not sure.
Yeah. Again, Aaron, I'm not telling you that the Gemara is going with my reason. I'm just saying if I were to stop here, that's the way my Rebbe used to teach us. You know, think about it. You know, if I were to stop here, I'd put it on pause and ask myself the question, is there a stira in Shmuel? On the one hand, Shmuel says, I need Rov Yisrael in order to violate the Shabbos. On the other hand, Shmuel says, Ein olchem mikuch nefshach harov. I would say, Tzvei Dinim, these are two different issues. But the Gemara doesn't go that way. The Gemara assumes that even if I have questions about the status of the Jew, I haven't even, of the child, I haven't even decided in the first premise, whether the child is assumed to be Jewish or not, even so, we're going to violate the Shabbos for the sake of Ein Holchem Bikuch Nefesh Arov. That's what the Gemara says. Eli Itmar Deshmuel Aresha Itmar. The Gemara is so convinced of its logic that the Gemara is going to absolutely reinterpret Shmuel from one polar extreme to the other polar extreme. Shmuel made his comment on the Reisha. What was the Reisha of this Mishnah? Im Rov Ovi Kochavim, Ovi Kochavim. Omar Shmuel, Ulfakeach Olav Esagal, Enoken. That in the case of violating the Shabbos, even if most of the city is comprised of a non-Jewish population, I still will violate the Shabbos because Ein Holchem B'Bikuach Nefesh Acharov. Now the Gemara asks, wait a minute. It says in the Reisha Rov Ovikochom Ovikochom Elamai Hilchasa. Why is that relevant? If you're telling me, Shmuel, that we would violate the Shabbos despite the fact that the city is mostly non-Jewish, so why did the Mishnah say that this case, this Rov Akum, the child is considered a guy? So I don't understand the Gemara's Kashi. I would have answered that as far as Mammon is concerned, as far as our responsibility to support him, maybe the Gemara thinks that if we don't support him, he'll die, and that's Lach Yoso is also a question of Bikuach Nefesh. What about Achzoras HaVeda? Let's say we don't know whether he's Jewish or not Jewish. Do we have to return a lost object to him? And maybe that itself should be dependent upon Rov or not Rov. Okay, so in any event, the Gemara is looking, we have to clarify why, for the relevancy of establishing based on Rov that the child is a guy. Amar Rav Papa, lachilo nevelos. What does it mean, lachilo nevelos? Rashi says, not here but elsewhere, that until such time as the child undergoes gerus, which apparently we're obligated to do, we have to raise the child to gerus, then we're allowed to feed the child tray for food. In other words, we treat the child as a goy. Why? Because of Rov. So it's a very odd, paradoxical situation. As far as violating the Shabbos is concerned, we're going to treat the child as if he were Jewish, based on the mute. But as far as feeding the child tray for food, we can treat him like a goy. Then we have the other extreme. Rov Yisrael, Yisrael, am I Hilchasa? Why do I need this new halach of Rov? We're going to be Mechal Shabbos even for a Rov Akum situation. And again, here I have a footnote. He says, as far as Lachilo Nevelos is concerned, well, even if it was Mechtzal Mechtza, we're not going to feed him treif. So why do you tell me that you need Rov Yisrael? So again, as far as A, saving his life, even if it's Rov Aku, as far as feeding him Nevelos, you're not allowed to feed him Nevelos, even if it's Mechtzal Mechtza. So to what extent, and relevant to what, do I need Rov Yisrael? So I don't know, I thought that the answer to that question is Liuchsin. But maybe the Gemara is holding that Shmuel also agrees to Rav, that you need two robes. I don't know. Omer Rav Papa, lahachzir lo aveda. Wow. This means the following. If you have a city that's 50-50, and this child now comes and claims the aveda as mine, then we have to return him the aveda.
A lost object? Is that what aveda means?
Just 1 second. Rov Yisrael Yisrael. I'm sorry. Did I say we have to return the aveda? That's what I said, right? Okay, cross that. Scratch that from the record. That if it's 50-50, we don't return the aveda to him. Right? When do we return the aveda to this child? That's only if it's Rov Yisrael. Why not in the case of Mechtzal Mechtza? See, writes here, Motzi Mechavel of Araya, which means that anytime you find something, you have rights to claim it as your own, until proven guilty otherwise, meaning until someone can prove that he deserves the object back, and Mechtzal Mechtza is not enough. So this child comes and he says, this is my object. I say, well, prove to me you're Jewish. And he cannot prove enough? So. It's only Mechtzal Mechtza.
Why is Rove enough?
That's the next question. Excellent.
Okay.
He says, V'kasha, harei ein motziin, eich motziin aveda miyada motziin rov Yisrael, harei ein holchim momen achar rov. His tirtzu atosis, this is all of a sechta yuma, keiman sha aveda eino sheyeches lemotze, ubitores aveda yigia liyado, bozekuli alma modim, the holchim momen achar rov. Very complicated set of rules. If there's Mechtzal Mechtza, then the finder has a right to say there's no statistical proof that you have rights to this aveda, and therefore I can claim it as my own. But the finder is not a full-fledged muchsak in order to apply the principle of Ein Holchim Momen Achar Rov. For that, we're going to say, look, you found it. You're not claiming it as your own. I mean, you're only claiming that in default, you know, if we don't find its owner, we can't locate the true owner, then you can keep it. Now we're going to apply the principles of, how should I say, universal clarifications of doubts. Meaning, klolei achros hasfekes. And the most profound of all the klolim is rov. So we have Rov that tells us that he's Jewish. That, see, again, according to my pshat, it's so much better, because once the Rov operates to establish the status of the child as a Jew, it's mainly after we machzir mavid. There's no issue of Ein Holchim Momen Achar Rov. Do you hear what I'm saying? But the Gemara is not assuming that for some reason. The Gemara is assuming that it's all one issue. The Gemara is not willing to split it into a shlav, which is the way I thought. You know, let's first determine the status of the child, and then we'll apply all the repercussions. No, the Gemara is saying that in every scenario, in every situation that arises, we have to use all these statistical probabilities. So now, this child comes to claim the aveda. What proof does he induce that he's a Jew in order to have rights to get back the aveda? The answer is he has a rov. I ain't holchim momen achar rov. That doesn't apply when the machzik is holding on to the object for someone, and we don't know who that someone is. We have reason to believe it's this child. The only issue is the child Jewish or not? And that's where rov comes in.
You're saying like he found something with this child's name on it? So
yeah.
It's like absolutely without a doubt his?
Yeah, it's a simon, whatever it is. So there's no issue again about the fact that he lost it. But
right.
The question is, when a guy loses something, even if I know it belongs to the guy, I'm allowed to keep it. But does this belong to a Jew or to a guy? And here's where Mechtz al Mechtz is not sufficient. I, the finder of right to be doche, to push him off and say, look, you have no objective hachros, hasofik, to prove and establish that you're Jewish, and the burden of proof is on you. Otherwise, I want to take it for myself. But once he, the child, brings a rov, and that establishes, based on rov, that he's Jewish, then we suspend the principle of Ein Olchem Bamelacha Rov in the case of Aveda, because the Motzi is holding on to it for the sake of somebody else. Mechtz al Mechtz Yisrael Lamai Hilchasa. Why do I need this din of Mechtz al Mechtz to establish him as a Jew? You just finished telling me that in our Shabbos Aveda, the burden of proof is on the child. He's not going to be able to claim this Aveda. You told me that as far as Yuchsin is concerned, even if there's Rov, we're not going to make him into a Jew. And you told me that as far as Lachilo Nevelos, what did we say? That only if it's Rov Akum are we allowed to be Machil him the Avedos. But in Mechtz al Mechtz, we would not be allowed to be Machil Avedos. So I don't need a special din of Mechtz al Mechtz Yisrael. So what is this? What's the thrust or the chidush of the Mishnah that Mechtz al Mechtz is Yisrael? So he has a question here. Why didn't the Gemara say Mechtz al Mechtz Yisrael Lach Yosef? And his answer we're going to only appreciate when we see the Gemara's answer. Meaning, the Shita Mekubetz is going to assume that at this point the Gemara had an answer in its back pocket, but the Gemara was looking for a better answer, more of a chidush. But truth be told, Mechtz al Mechtz Yisrael, without such a great, a radical, revolutionary chidush, on a simple pshat level, superficially, would mean Lach Yosef. That Beis Din is obligated to take from the community chest to support this guy because of Mechtz al Mechtz. But the Gemara is looking for a deeper chiddush.
It's like a chok, it's like a...
I don't know what you mean by chok, but that's the premise. That Mechtz al Mechtz, where we have a chiyuv of Lach Yosef, that's enough to impose an obligation on us Lach Yosef. On Reish Lakish comes up with a very great chiddush in this mission of Mechtz al Mechtz l'nezakin. Okay, now let's give a little bit of the background. There are two possible scenarios. If you learned a little Bava Kama, you'll remember this. If a shar that's owned by a Jew attacks a shar that's owned by a guy, the Torah says you're potter. If a shar that belongs to a guy attacks a shar that belongs to a Jew, you're chayev. Okay?
The guy is chayev?
The guy is chayev. And the distinction between shar tam and shar mu'ad, meaning the leniency for a shar tam to only pay chatzi nesek, that doesn't apply in the case of a shar shal goy. So shar shal akum, shenogach, shar shal yisrael, pays nesek shalim, even on the first occurrence. We have it so far? So what's the din again? I'm just testing you. If a shar shal yisrael, nogach shar shal akum, pot, what's the din if a shar shal akum, nogach shar shal yisrael, Chayv, how much? Nezik Shalim. Even on the first, Negicha.
So is
this we know from the Sefer Bava Kama. Okay, now, this child has a shar. Is the shar of this child that was found in the city, abandoned in the city, is that shar the Mazik or the Nizak? We have to go through all the possibilities. Hechi Domi. Inema, if it's a case of Dinagche Torah Didan LeTorah Diday, if our Jewish animal, our ox, how do you say it in English? Nogeach, gores. If it gores this child's ox, then buddy, I'm sorry, but go prove that you're a Jew and you have rights to collect damage. So again, if the shor of the child is the nizak, then for sure, in the case of Mechtz al Mechtz, we treat the shar as a shar shel guy. Because again, Amotzi v'chavero olav haraya. So it can't be the Mechtz al Mechtz Yisrael, and therefore he has rights to collect damages, because the Nizak has a right to say, I'm sorry, the Mazik has a right to say to the Nizak, go prove you're Jewish. Lemalei, I see Rayat Yisrael, Atu Shkol, until you bring a proof that you're a Jew, you don't have rights to collect. Lo Tzricha, but rather has to be the opposite scenario. Dinagchei Torah Didei, L'Torah Didan. Now the Shor of the child is the Shor Mazik. Okay? So now we want to sue the child for damages. So when we want to sue the child for damages, the child could claim, well, I'm Jewish. Now, if he claims I'm Jewish, then what kind of allowance do we give him?
He may get a free pass.
No, he doesn't get a free pass. I mean, again,
Tom, no,
you're giving him.
No, but a short Tom pays what? Chatzi Nezek. So free pass he won't get.
All right.
The question is, can we demand that this child will pay Nezek Shalim? So the Gemara says, Palga Mishalim. Half of the Nezek he's going to have to pay, as the din is by a short Tom Shal Yisrael. The Idach. But as far as the second Palga, to jack it up to Nezek Sholem for a short time if it's owned by a guy, Omar Lahu, now the child is talking to the Nizak, the Yisrael, I see Raya, the Lav Yisrael Ana, the Etei Lachon. Now the burden of proof is on you to establish that I'm a guy, and if I have to pay Nezek Sholem even on the first Negicha of a short time. So again, the child is in a funny situation. The Marashach, no matter how you slice the cake, the child has to pay Chatzi Nezek. Why? Because we Marashach. If the child is a guy, then the child has to pay Nezek Shalem, even though it's a short time. If the child is a Jew, then he has to pay Chatzi Nezek. So the Chiddush of this Mishnah in Mechzal Mechza is that the child has to pay Chatzi Nezek. Now the Nizak, that's the full-fledged Jew, is suing for full damages, claiming that the child is a guy. The guy, or the, I should say the Suffolk guy, has a right to turn to the Jew and say, now the burden of proof is on you. You want to collect from me the increment between Chatzi Nezek and Nezek Shalem, adduce proof that I am a guy, and since it's Mechzal Mechza, you can't prove that, therefore I don't have to pay. So again, in a sense, when it says Mechzal Mechza Yisrael, that's only vis-a-vis the discrepancy between Chatzi Nezek and Nezek Shalem. As a Yisrael, the Baal Ashar Mazik doesn't have to pay anything above Chatzi Nezek because it's a short time. So we treat him as a Yisrael. Go ahead, Aaron, please.
How about, I guess I'm kind of going backwards a little bit. How come this isn't considered a case of chol kavua v'masa kavua? Because the kid not being brought? Isn't the kid being like brought to Beis Din? Or we're just like pitum finding him in the street?
Right, we're finding him in the street.
We're just finding him in the street.
Right, so it's not just like finding a piece of meat in the street. You don't know where it came from.
Okay.
Here too, what house did this child come from? Well, maybe there were two hospitals. You know, there was a Jewish hospital and a non-Jewish hospital. Which hospital did the child come from? Hadron Alecha B'sula Nises, Hadron Alecha B'sula Nises. And now we can start our Isha Shemis Amala. The official seum was postponed till next week. Although I could use the schnapps tonight to maybe help my cold. It's okay, no, I'm just joking with you. Truthfully, I can't drink whiskey. It's unbelievable. One of the only failures of my education. My father loved the schnapps. You know, I mean, I remember I took my father to a bris of one of my students here in Eretz Yisrael. He settled in Eretz Yisrael. In fact, this the Bala Briss's brother is married to Rabbi Myers' daughter. Anyway, so I brought my father to this bris, and my father storms out of the bris. So I said, "Dad, what happened?" He says, "You call this a simcha, there's no schnapps." My schwer, I mean, forget it. I mean, he You know, he's nobody can challenge my shul.
Yeah, I've got a relative who knows your shul very well. He says he can drink a bottle of whiskey with a straw.
Yeah, he has. But the question is, you know, it didn't really pass on to the next generation. Although I'm hearing now that in the younger generation there really is an issue about drinking. You know, they're getting a little carried away. So now they're making takanos and kiddushim in America not to offer whiskey, but I don't know. It's
we very good, yeah.
Those takanos, I don't know, were meant to be broken, I think. You know, the elitists in any shul will have their own kiddush. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you don't drink whiskey, don't even bother showing up. I mean, they fill up a cup. Ha'isha shenis armula, onis garsha. Okay, a woman is collecting her ksuba under one of two scenarios. Either her husband dies and she's collecting it from the estate, or her husband divorced her. Now, the question is, how much of a ksuba does he have to pay? In theory, we should be able to look at the ksuba and figure it out. The ksuba tells you exactly whether she was a basula, or whether she was an almana, or whether she was already a second marriage. Does she get masayim zuz? Does she get only mayor zuz? He omeris basula is hasani. She, of course, is claiming the full masayim zuz. But who omer loki el almana nisatich? It was a second marriage. And the Mishnah is talking about a case where the shtar ksuba is lost, because otherwise we would just clarify the suffix by looking into the ksuba. So the Mishnah says as follows: Im yesh edim. Now, what do the edim have to see? Now, give it a break. The edim can't know whether she's a psula or not. But the answer is that the marriage ceremony itself was organized in a way that you can tell whether she was a psula or not. Why? She yotzas bihi numa. They had a special chuppah for a first marriage. I'm saying for her it's a first marriage. I don't care, he may have been married 20 times, it's not relevant. And that marriage is called Hinuma. Now, Hinuma is translated here as a Hadas Agula. They put a crown on her head, which was made of Hadassim, in a round kind of circle. I don't know if you've ever seen the Yemenites on Sukkot. They have beautiful, what they do with Hadassim is absolutely stunning. I don't know if you've ever seen it. A second possibility, another way of clarifying that this was a chupas besula, is rosha parua. In other words, when they took her from her father's house to the chupa, if she was a besula, the minig was that she would, the hairs on her head were exposed. She didn't have to cover her hair. If it was a second marriage, she would cover her hair. Again, all these things have changed over the course of time, but that was the original bit. So we have two Aiden testifying that when this woman went to the wedding, she went to the wedding as a basula, and therefore even in the absence of the document, the shtar ksuba, we have the assumption that she gets ksubasa masayim. This is all according to the Tanakh. There are only two possibilities: either number one, Yotzes Binuma, or number two, Parua Rosha. Rav Yochanan ben Broka, he adds a third possible evidence: Af Chiluk Kloyos Raya. Now, he claims, you know, today they throw rice and stuff like that. I think that's a goyish meaning. But the truth is, there's a source for it in Judaism. A lot of them in Hagim are deviations of Judaism. But in Judaism, they had a minhag that there was a special simcha for a woman who's getting married for the first time. And that, in order to enhance the simcha, they used to give out candies. But instead of candies, they gave out klayot. Klayot are roasted nuts. That was like a delicacy. You know, this reminds me of an afruf, you know, when they throw candies. You know, this is all Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, and this was the Sue Basula. So therefore, according to Rabbi Yochanan, if the testimony is such that at the time of her chuppah they gave out these kloyos, that's sufficient proof in order to establish that she gets masayim. Now I just want to pause here for a moment. The whole premise of this Mishnah is a gewaldige chidush. Because in a case where he claims that he only owes her 100, and she sues him for 200, l'chora, what famous principle should kick in? Hamotzapel Varaya. Now, Raya means Eidu. Okay, there's circumstantial evidence, but that's not really Eidus. The Mishnah is establishing that we upgrade these circumstantial proofs to the status of Eidim, so that she, as the plaintiff, now could collect 200. At this point, the Gemara goes back, the Mishnah goes back to the old machlokas, don't get nervous, between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua, whether a woman is believed to claim her ksuva and to be motzi mamon based on that tvia through a migu. Let's just review the migu. According to Rabbi Gamliel, if a woman is found to be a ba'ula, that means he comes and he finds her after the marriage, after the consummation of the marriage, to be a ba'ula, she's believed to say that she was raped after the erusin. Because again, the chiyuv of psula, of masayim psuz, is engraved in stone at the time of what? Of the erusin. So that's called Mishrastani Nenasti. Why is that a migu? Because if she was lying, she could have gotten away with a much lighter claim, without a self-accusation of sorts. I'll explain what I mean in a minute. And she could have claimed, Mukad Eitz on me. I had some sort of mishap, and I lost my Mesulah. The nafkamina is that there's a very great drawback to saying, Mishrastani Nenasti. She'll never be able to marry a Kohen. Right. Because she's a married woman, and she was raped by another man, she can never marry Cohen. But she's willing to tell the truth, even though by admitting that she had this onus, she will be pasul l'kuhuna henceforth. But let's believe her that she's not lying, says Rav Gamliel, because if she was a real first-class liar, she would have taken a much more convenient path, the higher road, and she would have said, Bukas Eitz ani. Rabbi Yeshua, on the other hand, says that she's not believed. Why? Because that's considered a migu lahotzi, and migu lahotzi lo amrinon. Even though migu is a, you know, has some weight as evidence, but it's not great enough. It doesn't shine up to the status of two edim. And amotzi mechavel v'raya means you have to bring two witnesses. Says the Mishnah, umode Rabbi Yeshua. There's one case in which even Rabbi Yeshua admits to Rabbi Gamliel, and Migu Lahotzi is powerful enough, like two Eidim. What's the case? Normally, when there's a Tviya and a Nitba, the Tover and a Nitba, the plaintiff is well aware of his rights, and therefore he sues the defendant. What happens if it's the defendant who tells the plaintiff about his rights? What's the case? Ha'omel chaviro, Ruvein says to Shimon, Sada zu, I'm holding on to the Sada, I'll be working the Sada, I'm taking the fruits of the field, and so forth. Shalavicha ha'isa, it belonged to your father. In other words, the plaintiff, so to speak, meaning Shimon, he's not even aware of his claim. His father left him absolutely no, you know, last will and testament to indicate that this field belonged to him. The only way he could even know that this field ever belonged to his ancestors, to his father, is through the admission of Reuven, who's now living on the field. Then Reuven adds, "Ulekachtiyo heimena," but I bought it from your father. Where's your shtar? In other words, now all of a sudden, Shimon gets very smart here. My father originally was the owner of this karka. Anyone who claims ownership against what's called a marakama, who had certain ownership at one point in history, such a claimant has to produce a shtar. Where's your shtar? Says Rabbi Yeshua, Hudemah. We believe Reuven. Why do we believe Reuven? After all, he doesn't produce a shtar that he bought it from Shimon. And the answer is, Shapesha Asar Huapesha Hit. Is everybody familiar with that?
I am.
Yeah?
Yes.
Does that ring a bell? Hapesha Asar Huapesha Hit, meaning if this guy, Reuven, was a liar, he didn't have to say a word. Silence is golden. Do you ever hear of a famous Yiddish short story called Bunch of Schweig? No, you don't know. One time I'll tell you. It's a very powerful short story. I forgot who wrote it. One of the famous Yiddish writers.
Or Soloveitchik quotes that story.
Oh yeah, bunch of Schweig. Anyway, Schweig in Yiddish means to be silent. And in this case, Ruve was putting his foot into his mouth to say that Bechlal, there's an Iser. So for example, let's say we assume a woman was not married, so we can marry her off to anyone. Then she comes forward and she says, I was married. But then she turns around and she said, but I got a divorce. Where's your get? I lost it. So on the one hand, she admits that she was married. Now we need two edim, or get, to establish that she's allowed to get married, that she was divorced. But Apesha also, Apesha Ita, she didn't have to say a word. We had assumed that she was never married. She put her foot into her mouth, I mean, not literally, but and told us that she was married. It's Apesha also, Apesha Ita, here too.
Oh, the psychology isn't correct there. I can tell you, people come now, we work at Amnesty, and people say, listen, I've got this money and I want to pay the taxes for the last 5 years. They ask them, where did they get the money from? They can't remember. You know, or came from Yerusha, where's the Yerusha? Because most of us won't accept it unless it's from Yerusha. Mm.
So meaning what's the admit?
I'm saying sometimes people come along and they'll say, because they know that everybody knows that they were married. They come along and say, correct, I was married.
Ah.
But I was divorced. Because the whole world knows that they were married. Nobody knows about the divorce.
So if the world knows about the marriage that they were married, that's the next line in the Mishnah. But V'im Yesh Edim Shehi Shel Aviv. Let's say we have independent evidence, which you know, Shimon now could adduce, he could subpoena to Edim, that testify that we know that this karka once belonged to Shimon's father. We'll call him Yaakov. You know, they could testify that this karka belonged to Yaakov. V'hu omer, but now Reuven is claiming, l'kachtia haymenu, I bought it from Yaakov, the late father. It's Eino Neman. He's not believed. Because again, if a person claims he bought karka, he must establish that with a shtar. If he cannot produce a shtar, we don't believe him for a zilch that he bought the karka. If we have no proof to establish that the father ever owned the karka, that, says Rabbi Yeshua, I admit, that's a peshas and peshit. Now, let's take a minute. What's the difference between migu and peshas and peshit? In the case of Migu, the Baal is claiming Lo Matzasi Lebitcha Besulit. It's not Pesach Pasuch Matzasi. So he's already indicating that he doesn't want to pay the 200 zuz for Besula because she fooled him. Now she says, "Well, Bisharas Tani Nasti, and we want to believe her with a Migu." That's already. Monday morning quarterbacking, you know, that's already after the fact, you know. But in the case of Sada Zushal Avicha Haisa, and there's no independent evidence whatsoever, not even a hair's breadth, of anyone who remembers from their youth that this karka, this piece of property, was owned by their father, that's a Pesha, a Peshahite. Why? Because then, what, you know, if you want to listen to Reuven, and if not for Reuven, you have no basis to establish upon which to establish that this karka ever belonged to Yaakov, the father of Shimon, then if you're listening to his testimony, you have to accept the whole testimony. You can't stop him halfway and say, well, you know, we'll believe you that this karka belonged to, you know, to Yaakov, but we're not going to believe you that you purchased it from Yaakov. That doesn't make any sense. If he is the source of this piece of information, we have no independent source, then, you know, believe him in the whole story. You can't stop him in the middle. That's called a pesha asar, who a pesha hiti.
Why do we believe him at all for the whole thing?
Well, there's a principle called Hodas Paltin Kimei Eidim Dali, meaning if I admit that this field once belonged to your family, then the halacha trusts me. Because again, that's called Hodas Paltin. When I admit something in financial claim that works against me, then my testimony is reliable. The Gemara says the following. Taima Dika Edu.
No, sorry, but a person should come and just do it like that, just that they'll believe the second part of the story. He comes and says, yes, I know the property belonged to your father, but I bought it from him.
Right.
I mean, well, he didn't buy it from him, but he wants to make like he's a good guy. And he says, listen, I know it really belonged to your father.
But is there any basis for the claim other than his own confession, his own admission that it ever belonged to his father?
He doesn't have the star, all right?
But I'm saying, you know, if all the information comes from him, then it's not fair to accept half of his story. You know, it doesn't make any sense. Hapesha also Hapesha Yitir. For example, let's say a father says that I married off my daughter to so-and-so. So we're going to say the following. Oh, I'll believe you that you married off your daughter, but I'm not going to believe you that it was to so-and-so. And if this guy gives a get, that's not going to be sufficient. We have to assume maybe there was some other guy. Esbiti nosati li'isha zeh. If you believe the father to say that he married off his daughter, believe him all the way, and he can identify the Mekadesh.
I'm asking, why do we even believe him? Because... like let's say that I go in and I say that field belonged to your father, and currently that field is really owned by I don't know, Max. You don't believe me. You need to aid him because don't you have? Isn't there any of
again? There's only one person in the world who has a viable claim to this karka. That's called the Maxik. That's this guy Ruve that I've been talking to you about. He's living in the karka. He is working the karka as if it was his from Sheshi Simei Brachis. So, what else? There's no one else who's in the picture. No one else has a claim to this karka.
He's been there for 10 years. Nobody said anything.
Well, again, the point, I don't know how many years he's been there, but there's no claim to the karka. So, what's the point? Oh, he admits that it belonged way back when to someone's father. So what? I'll trust you on that. But I can't stop you in the middle when you say, okay, now in the 5 minutes that we have left, the Mishnah says that there are Edim who testify that Yotzes Binuma or Parua Rosha, Taima Dika Edim, Haleka Edim, Baal Nehemon, in the absence of this testimony of circumstantial evidence that she was a psula at the time of the marriage, we're going to assume that the Baal is correct. When he claims that she was a second marriage and he only wants to pay her 100, is Tnad Stoma de Loker Rabbi Gamliel? Is this mission against Rabbi Gamliel? De E Rabbi Gamliel Ha'omar Ihi Mehemna. If you recall, Rabbi Gamliel back on Daf Yud Beis Amud Beis in his Machlokas against Rabbi Yeshua says that a woman, if she was married Bechezkas Besula, and at the end of the day, we didn't find Besula. The Baal Tainas that she lost her Besula before the Erisin. She Tainas, no, she lost her Besula after the Erisin. Is Rabbi Gamliel says she's believed. Why? Because she has a Chezkas Besula. In other words, every woman, unless we have proof otherwise, has a Chazaka, which is an assumption that the Halacha operates with, according to Rabbi Gamliel, that she's a Besula. And she's believed to claim that she was a Besula. Again, Rabbi Yeshua argues and he says, no, the Baal is believed because, you know, we don't want to force the Baal to pay the Ksuba of Masayim until she brings a proof. But Rabbi Gamliel insists that she doesn't have to bring a proof because she has a Chezkas Besula. So is our Mishnah against Rabbi Gamliel? The Gemara is not happy about that because, in fact, we paskin in that Mishnah Daf Yud Beis like Rabbi Gamliel. Ha'amar Rabbi Gamliel says, "I mehemna." She, according to Rabbi Gamliel, in that Mishnah is believed. She's believed because of Acheskas Aguf, that she was born a Besula, and until we know that she's not a Besula, we believe her to say she is a Besula. Says the Gemara, "Filu Teva." Rabbi Gamliel. This Mishnah is not a contradiction to Rabbi Gamliel. Ad kan lo kol Rabbi Gamliel hasam ela bivari v'shema. He doesn't know exactly when she lost her Besulin. Was it before the Erisin or after the Erisin? So she comes forward with a Titus Bari and she says, not lo, you said it that I lost the Besulin before the Erisin. No, I lost the Besulin after the Erisin. And she knows that for certain. That's a Titus Bari. And that Titus Bari is supported by her Chezkas Besulah. Aval Hochman in our Mishnah, Bibari Ubari. The Baal is claiming that when I married you with the ksuba of Be'er as a second marriage. Again, the ksuba is God, we don't have the document, but that's his claim. So it's one Titus Bari against another Titus Bari. Lo Amar of Yochanan, Rabbi Gamliel never said in Bari Ubari that she's believed. So again, when does Rabbi Gamliel rely on Cheskas Pesula? That's only if the Cheskas Pesula is supported by Titus Bari, whereas he, the Baal, is claiming a Titus Shema. But if the Baal has a Titus Bari, like in our Mishnah, and she comes with a counter Titus Bari, then Rabbi Gamliel admits that we don't rely on a Cheskas Pesula. The Gemara says, "With the Kari by Kari Lay." What were you thinking when you asked this question? What was the Hava meaning that our mission is against Rabbi Gamliel? Habariu Barihu. The Gemara answers, "Came in the Rove Nashim Besulos Nisos Ki Bari Veshema Dami." In other words, she has two pieces of evidence to support her claim. Number one, she has a Cheskas Besula because she's born a Besula. Number two, she has a rove. Most women are first marriage women. And he has a Titus Bari. So when she brings two proofs to support her Titus Bari, and he only has a Titus Bari without any proof, that becomes like Bari Veshema. Meaning, we don't really trust him to say, well, it was a second marriage. Why should we assume it's a second marriage? That's the exception rather than the rule. To boot, she's supported by Cheskas Pesula. And therefore, the Maksha thought that if we were to reflect the Shita of Rabbi Gamliel, then in this case, she would be believed even without Eidim. She doesn't have two Eidim who testify about the nature and the arrangement at her chuppah. Hachinam Mistabra, just trying to get to the punchline before they call us for Mayriv. Minik Tani, since it says in the Mishnah, Moder of Yeshua, that in the case of a Peshas and Peshiter, Rabbi Yeshua admits that we believe a Peshas and Peshiter. If the mission is going according to Rabbi Gamliel, is Shapir, then it makes sense in the rest of the Mishnah that Rabbi Yeshua admits to Rabbi Yeshua's position in the case of Peshas and Peshiter. El Iamit lo Iri Rabbi Gamliel b'modeh. If the original ratio of the Mishnah is against Rabbi Gamliel, because Rabbi Gamliel would not require two Eidim to support her claim, right, because she's supported by both a Cheskas Psula and a Rove, is then, what does it mean, Rabbi Yeshua's modeh to Rabbi Gamliel? There's no Rabbi Gamliel here in our Mishnah. Rabbi Gamliel doesn't even have a footnote in our Mishnah. So the Gemara answers, no, me Savris, Rabbi Yeshua, I Pirkin Koi. We look at our Mishnah as an independent literary entity. And we look within the Mishnah to assume that Rabbi Yeshua is being moda to the ratio of this Mishnah. No. It's not on this Perek, the second Perek, but rather Amigu Koi Pirkin the Kamakam Koi. Rabbi Yeshua is admitting to Rabbi Gamliel with regard to the first parak, where Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua were at loggerheads, you know, they were debating back and forth whether she would believe in the case of Misharastani de Nasti. She has a migu, she could have said Mukas Eitz. And Rabbi Yeshua says, I don't rely on that migu to allow her to collect Masayim Zuz. It's a migu lahotzi, migu lahotzi lo amrinon. On that, Rabbi Yeshua says, I'm molded to you in a case of Peshasar, of Peshahitir. Now, what I just want to give you an introduction to the next year. Once we've gotten to the position that Rabbi Yeshua's statement in Peshasar, Peshahitir, he's molded to Rabbi Gamliel, refers back to the first parak, we're going to go through every single possible scenario where there was a machlokas in the first parak between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua, and see where we can find that the glove fits. On which statement of Rabbi Gamliel, which Rabbi Yeshua rejected, was he moda in the case of a Peshasa Peshita? Okay, then? So we'll stop here. Thank you so much.